Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. I'm Mark Labriola, and in this episode, obesity medicine specialist and OMA clinical education director, Dr. Nicholas Pennings, interviews Dr. Marion Nessel, a keynote speaker from Overcoming Obesity 2019, about the influences of the food industry in the rise of obesity. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leader in obesity medicine.
Welcome to the OMA podcast. I'm Dr. Nick Pennings, Chair of Family Medicine at Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine. And I have with me today Dr. Marion Nessel. She is a consumer advocate, nutritionist, award-winning author, and academic who specializes in the politics of food and dietary choice. Her research examines scientific, economic, and social influences on food choice and obesity, with emphasis on the influence of the food industry marketing. Her books explore issues like the effects of food production on dietary intake, food safety, and access to food and nutrition. Welcome to the podcast today.
Oh, glad to be here.
I hope you had a nice trip here.
It worked.
That's good. Dr. Nessel is giving the keynote address at the OMA conference, the Obesity Summit 2019. So I wanted to start with a question regarding obesity rates in the United States. So last month, the CDC released its latest data on obesity rates in the United States. And as we see, obesity continues to rise, especially among Hispanic and non-Hispanic Black populations. Wanted to ask you what your thoughts are with respect to government food policies and its impact on minorities. Is there a disproportionate impact on minorities? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there is a disproportionate impact, in part because the food industry targets minority groups for special marketing efforts and has made intense inroads into minority communities. It's worked very hard on that over the last 40 years, abetted by government, so that government policies about putting fast food in low-income areas, for example, have been the subject of a couple of books that have come out recently. The food industry has figured out that it can become partner with low-income minority groups and in that way sort of embed themselves in the culture of those groups. And so it's very difficult to talk to minority groups about eating less fast food, drinking fewer soft drinks, or doing any of the basic steps that people who are white and educated are trying very hard to do, or soda taxes, for example, are very, very difficult to deal with in minority communities because the soda industry has been in there doing community organizing for decades, and public health people have not.
Mm. And in some minority communities, one of the issues are food deserts. And the fast food industry potentially fills a void for a food desert, or is it creating food deserts by people opting for fast foods versus purchasing their foods and preparing their own foods?
Mm. Yeah, food deserts is becoming a politically incorrect term these days, and so I don't like to talk about it because a lot of the research shows that that's a problem mainly in rural areas and urban areas. It's less of a problem. But fast food has moved into the gap. If supermarkets left because they thought they couldn't make enough money in low-income areas, then fast food places and liquor stores moved in. And that's an apparent problem. A lot of people are working on attempting to bring farmers markets and fruits and vegetables into low-income communities. But unless the demand for these things is coming from the communities themselves, it's very unlikely to work.
Right. And I think working on demand is really important, that people, as long as people are supporting those industries, they're going to continue to flourish.
Well, and as long as those industries are supporting the aspirations and the organizations that low-income people belong to. I mean, if you want to see how this works, all you have to do is go on the Coca-Cola transparency site, where Coca-Cola very nicely lists every organization and every individual to whom it, and which it gives money. And you can see the number of minority groups that they are helping to support. So from the standpoint of public health, that's an enormous problem.
So along those lines, we've had a shift in obesity rates that was obesity used to be a condition that primarily affected the wealthy who could afford enough food mm-hmm. to become obese. Now the shift is we're seeing it more in lower socioeconomic groups. What do you think obesity medicine specialists can do to help disadvantaged populations with obesity get to a healthier weight?
Well, I think you have to help educate people about why they are the targets of so much food industry marketing and what all that is about. The solution to weight problems is to eat less, which is difficult for everybody. And now we have a very easy way of talking about that. You want people to eat less of ultra-processed foods, which have a specific definition, now backed up by extraordinary amounts of evidence all in the last couple of years. I see it as a major breakthrough in helping people understand which foods are okay and which foods are not okay. But unless you have people, I don't know how else to put this, with some political consciousness about what's going on, it's really difficult because, you know, if you're a white person telling people of color what to do, that has a resonance of arrogance to it. It's very difficult. I think you have to, I'm a great believer in community organizing. What do people in these communities want? That would be my starting place.
Right. And one of the things I try to emphasize is I think we all have a common goal, is that we want to be healthy, right? Nobody really wants to be unhealthy. And making that a common goal and mm-hmm. then helping people to recognize what foods that they're consuming and what their activity levels and how it's impacting their health versus just whether this is good food or bad food, or I think it has a very different connotation and meaning and not felt as being judgmental.
Well, what troubles me about it is that you have so little time to deal with these kinds of issues in a way that's going to work. You know, as a medical patient myself, I'm lucky if I see my doctor for 15 minutes. There's no time in that to talk about sociological issues connected with diet and health. So one of the big issues about treating obese patients, it seems to me, is trying to figure out where the support system is. I think that physicians have an enormously important role in inspiring people to make changes in their lives, and the question is how to do that in a way that's meaningful and that works.
I think that's a great point. It is challenging in the narrow time that we have and with a patient. One of the things that is helpful is to really work with patients to set just one or two simple goals, mm-hmm. identifying, and I'll often ask patients, what's the least healthy aspect of your diet? And once they tell me, what can you do about it? What changes are you willing to make? Shifting the ownership to them, mm-hmm. that I find to be more effective. Mm-hmm. But you're not going to succeed with a mindset that you're going to fix everything in one visit. In 15 minutes. You really need to work at it a little bit at a time.
I think it's terrific if you could fix anything in 15 minutes.
That's true.
Don't get me started on the current medical system.
What should obesity medicine specialists take from the U.S. dietary guidelines to help them with their patients? And what should they ignore? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think they can ignore the whole thing. The last dietary guidelines were 144 pages and written in incomprehensible language, self-canceling phrases and euphemisms. Very, very difficult to understand. They're so heavily politicized. And the new dietary guidelines that are underway right now are being the research on them is being prepared by a committee that has very strong ties to food companies. And in fact, the chairs of the committee have very strong ties to food companies. So I'm not expecting a strong public health message to come out of them. I think they will continue to be euphemistic. And in any case, the committee doesn't write them. The agencies do, and the Department of Agriculture is the lead agency this year. And the Department of Agriculture is working very hard on promoting the Trump agenda.
So looking there at perhaps, you know, the guidelines being directed more by industry. So what would you like to see happen? What would make more sense? Where should we get our guidance for or information for dietary guidance for our patients?
Well, to me, dietary guidance is very simple. You eat a lot of fruits and vegetables, you don't eat too much junk food, and you balance calories. Really, it's as simple as that. There are an enormous number of dietary patterns that are healthful and lots of very delicious ways to eat. I think that, you know, that food is one of life's greatest pleasures, and that's enormously important. And really, it's very simple. You just don't eat too much. It's just that it's so hard to do that in an environment in which ultra-processed foods, I'm going to use that term again because it has a precise definition. These are junk foods that are heavily processed, don't look like the foods they came from, are loaded with additives of one kind or another, and are high in sugar and salt, and industrially produced. And, you know, everybody knows what they are. They're the worst of the junk foods. There's now evidence that people who eat these foods take in more calories and gain weight. Under very controlled conditions. And that means that out in the real world, those are the foods to avoid. The first thing I tell people is don't drink sodas. When I wrote my book Soda Politics, I didn't write it as a diet book, but I got letters from people afterwards saying, I read your book, I stopped drinking sodas, I lost 10 pounds. I lost 20 pounds. I lost 40 pounds. The record was 80.
Wow.
Making no other change, no other change.
So one of the things I like to say that many times these things are simple, they're just not easy. And with respect to that, the challenges that we have is how ubiquitous those foods are in our society.
Mm-hmm.
They're a big part of the workplace, they're a big part of social life, they become present at meetings and other events. So there are so many events in our life that center around food and typically around unhealthy foods, that it's hard for many people to not consume those things when everybody around them is consuming.
It's impossible. You know, we're human. If there's food in front of us, we're going to eat it, especially if we like it. And these foods are formulated to be likable, to be delicious, to make people not able to stop. I mean, that's and we're human. We respond to that, and food companies know this and have sunk fortunes into creating food products that will encourage us to not be able to stop on it. Their
right.
job is to sell foods, as I'm fond of saying. Food companies are not public service agencies. They're not public health agencies. They're businesses. Their job is to get you to eat more, not less.
Right. Consumption, right? That's... You discussed the influence of the industry funding on nutrition research. How should healthcare providers evaluate nutritional studies to identify the stealth influence of commercial interests in scientific research?
Well, fortunately, most medical journals require their authors to disclose whether they have connections with companies that might have a vested interest in the results of the research. Some do, some don't. The level of compliance with that particular requirement is not particularly high, apparently, researchers have shown. But certainly, if a study is funded by a food industry or food company with an interest in the outcome of the research, know that there's tons of research that demonstrates that industry-funded studies almost invariably come out with results that favor the sponsor's interest. And that's been shown in the chemical industry, the pharmaceutical drug industry, the tobacco industry, over and over and over again. I tried to do that for the food industry. It's a little bit harder to do because there's so few studies and they're so recent. Unlike the pharmaceutical drugs, where there have been complaints about drug industry funding of research for 50 years. It's much more recent in the food area. But the few studies that have been done give pretty much the same result.
And a lot of these fundings are done not in the name of a large corporation, but under organizations that sometimes are hard to decipher exactly who is it that is sponsoring that.
Oh, yeah. There's a very interesting example this very week as we speak in the International Life Sciences Institute, which positions itself as an independent think tank, but is fully funded, almost fully funded by food companies. And it funds a lot of research that demonstrates that sugar's not a problem, that lots of other things aren't problems, and it does a lot of work internationally to try to get governments to focus on physical activity as an approach to dealing with the obesity problem rather than diet.
Right. That was something you mentioned in your recent book.
Yes.
Yes. It's worth reading.
But there'll be a lot more about ILSI coming out in the press because of some recent studies on meat.
Okay. The term food science sounds like it's about nutritional value of food. What is food science and what is it not?
Well, food science is a field in which the people try to develop food products. It's food technology. It's the wonders of food technology. Developing new products, looking at what they are. In the past, it was not interested in health. It was never about health. It was about developing the best kind of yogurt or making sure that milk didn't go sour and other kinds of basic physical problems connected with foods. It grew up as a academic enterprise to support the food industry. What's the best way to feed chickens? What's the best way to, I think the milk example is a good one. You know, how do we pasteurize milk and how do we do all those things? And only recently have food scientists started turning to health, and that then brings them into the nutrition science area, which has always been about health.
Okay, thank you. So nutrition fact labels, do they help? What is the status of the changes that have been proposed for nutrition fact labels?
Well, the new nutrition facts labels go into effect in 2020. And many, many food products now have the new labels on them. Some don't, but many do. And the main differences that I'm interested in were they make the calories larger. I'm a calorie person, so I care about that. And then they now also list added sugars, which I think is also quite useful. Otherwise, they look pretty much the same. And most people who figured out how to deal with the last ones will be able to figure out how to deal with these pretty well. They're not intuitively obvious. And when the FDA first established the food label in the early 1900s, it did a lot of focus group testing on consumer understanding of various label models. And the way I like to put it is nobody could understand any of them, and they picked the least worst. And so this is a slight improvement to the least worst, but it's still pretty hard for a lot of people to understand. I understand them. I study these things.
And, of course, you have to look at them, too. You have to bother
to
look at them.
You definitely do. And I love going into supermarkets and seeing people looking at them. I think that's great. Trying to make sense of it. Most people just look at the calories and sugar.
Yes, yes. And I think that speaks a little bit to the benefits of the simplification or magnification of those items so that people can really look at some key items on the nutrition label and not let all the data get lost.
Yeah, I should say that the cutting edge of food labeling these days is front of package labels. And the FDA, 10 years ago now, did a big research project through the national academies to try to develop a front of package label that would sort of simplify, give a yes or no on the food label. And the committee wrote two reports, and those reports went right smack into a drawer, and nobody's ever looked at them. But countries all over the world now, particularly in Latin America, are looking at food labels. The Mexican government, in the first stage of the Mexican government, just passed a front of package warning label just this week. And Chile, Peru, Israel, several other countries have warning labels on products that are high in sugar, fat, or salt.
So any one of those items, they single out and put a warning label on?
Yeah, the Chilean label has a system of little black labels that that go on if it's high in fat, high in sugar, high in saturated fat, high in sugar, high in salt, high in calories, and they focus group tested those labels on children. They wanted children to be able to understand those labels. Even a child can figure out right away. And those labels go on the front of packages of sugary cereals, for example. And there are many, many examples now of kids going down the supermarket aisles with their parents saying, not that one. In Chile, they also took the cartoons off.
That's
kids,
great.
Kids' cereals.
Yeah.
So other countries are way ahead of us.
That's great. That's great. And targeting children for education and nutrition and being able to influence in a positive way nutritional choices, I think, is a very important task. Even before that, epigenetics is another hot topic in the science of obesity. What impact does our food supply have on epigenetic risk of obesity?
Well, I'm sure it has an effect, but I don't know what that effect is.
Okay. All right. Very good.
It's being studied. I find the studies fascinating, but I don't know what they mean yet.
One of the comments you often hear people say that healthy food is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that?
It is. It is. If you look at Department of Commerce data on the rise in prices of food over the last 30 years, there's a very clear trend where the price of fruits and vegetables has increased much more rapidly than the price of sodas, fast food, junk food in general, what we would call ultra-processed foods, much lower than the average price, whereas for fresh fruits and vegetables, or even any kind of fruits and vegetables, it's higher. It's gone up faster than the average. So if people think that fruits and vegetables are expensive, it's because they are. And of course, is due to government policy.
That was my next question, is what do you think might help that?
Well, government policy might help that. Right now, the government subsidizes. My favorite government subsidy is that marketing to children is a business expense that is entirely deductible from taxes. And that's about $30 billion a year in food company marketing. Not necessarily all aimed at children, but just in general. So that's a subsidy, a tax advantage. We subsidize corn production, soybean production, and the main effect of those subsidies is to encourage the producers to produce more. That reduces the price of those ingredients. Those ingredients go into junk foods.
Right.
Or high fructose corn syrup or all kinds of things like that. So what we don't have is a agricultural policy that's linked to health policy. I think we need one.
That sounds like a wonderful idea. Well, I'd like to thank you very much for participating in this podcast today, and I look forward to your talk to the OMA.
Thanks very much. It was fun to be here.
Thank you, Dr. Pennings and Nessel. For more information about Obesity Medicine podcasts and other resources from the clinical leader in obesity medicine, please visit obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. Love this episode of Obesity, a Disease? Head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. The views expressed in this podcast episode are those of the show host and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please check back soon for another episode of Obesity, a Disease.